Pie in the Sky Media. This series contains adult language and descriptions of graphic violence throughout. Listener discretion is advised.
So in that early 90s area, you were in the Phoenix area. You lived in there. Do you remember hearing any news articles about any ladies being killed?
Probably saw a few.
Do you remember any specific ones? And you told me that around the Metro Center area on the bike paths and the canals, you weren't ever around there. Maybe once in a while.
Yeah, once in a while, not like a regular thing.
Do you remember the name Angela Brasso at all?
Yeah.
Well, she was killed around the bike paths in 1992. And then in 1993, there's a girl by the name of Melanie Burnett who was also killed around the bike, you know, the canals and the bike paths over there. And there's some DNA evidence that kind of links you to those girls. Is there any way you can explain that to them?
No, I don't know those names.
Well, any girl in particular, whether you remember their name or not, how would your DNA evidence be linked to them?
I have no clue.
You have no clue about...
No.
Welcome back to Criminal Mischief with Carolyn and Brandon. You're listening to episode 72, part 2 of The Zombie Hunter. If you haven't already, make sure to go back and listen to episode 71 first, part 1 of The Zombie Hunter. In July of 1992, 22-year-old Angela Brasso went on a bike ride at dusk. Her regular routine was cruising along the popular Phoenix Canal bike path, which thread through the city. But that night, she never came home. The next day, her nude body was found in a vacant field near the canal. She'd been sexually assaulted. The killer had attempted to cut her body in half, and she'd been decapitated.
Troy, last name's Hillman, H-I-L-L-M-A-N, and my title was a retired detective sergeant with the Phoenix Police Department.
About 9 o'clock that morning, the next morning, she was found pretty close actually to her apartment complex. And it was a pretty grotesque scene up on a berm. Angela was laying there and she was nude except for her socks. Her clothing was kind of strewn about her body and she'd been beheaded and the head was not at the scene.
11 days later, near a grate in the canal, Angela's head would be found. During autopsy, it would be determined that based on the level of decomposition, not only had the killer taken her head, but he'd stored it for 10 days in a refrigerator before bringing it back to the canal, roughly 2 miles away from where Angela's body had been recovered. 11 months later, in September of 1993, the killer would strike again. The body of 17-year-old Melanie Burness would be found floating in the canal near where Angela's head had been recovered. Melanie, too, had been sexually assaulted. Her body had been mutilated and symbols had been carved into her skin. She'd been redressed in a child's bodysuit that the killer had brought with him.
It was almost like a one-piece swimwear, but it was designated as a bodysuit by Park Lane, but it was designed for a small child. And Melanie was a well-developed 17-year-old female. So, you know, when she was found, her breast area was kind of protruding and it was just obvious that it was pulled up and it was obvious that it was not her bodysuit. And it was obvious that the perpetrator had brought that with him to the crime scene and redressed her post-mortem.
Police received thousands of tips. And since both young women had been murdered between 7 and 9 p.m., investigators would conduct bike riding stakeouts along the canal, hoping the killer would strike again. It was believed that Angela and Melanie had been attacked within yards of the bike path, and that the killer then dragged them away under the cover of canal tunnels, which were located every so often along the path. But the killer didn't bite. There were no more murders on the canal, and no one would ever come forward saying that they'd heard or seen anything, which was unbelievable. The attacks had been so brazen. The canal bike paths were really popular and near the freeway and nearby shopping centers and apartments. It seemed inconceivable that there'd been no witnesses. Investigators believe that both victims had been stabbed near those intermittent tunnels which connected to the canal. Was this a part of the killer's ploy to get Angela and Melanie to slow down and talk to him long enough so that he could stab them in that very particular place in the back, killing them almost instantly, and then dragging their bodies away to a secluded spot. The killer had left behind his semen on both victims. And later, as DNA evidence evolved, investigators would get confirmation of what they already believed, that they were looking for one killer. But when they submitted the DNA profile to CODIS, they wouldn't get a hit, which meant the killer wasn't in the system. Now, when a profile is submitted to CODIS, it's always there, waiting to be matched with another criminal investigation. But over the years, nothing matched, which led many to believe that the killer was dead or in prison, or that he'd moved on to a new place and had kept killing, but hadn't been caught. Based on his FBI profile, he wouldn't stop. Ultimately, both cases went cold, and the years would roll on until 2011, when a new cold case squad would breathe life into the case. A local news station had submitted a public disclosure request. They were planning to do a comprehensive update on the case. If you'll recall, retired Phoenix Police Sergeant Troy Hillman had been designated to oversee that request.
A lot went on from the time we picked it up as a cold case squad. And I say it was a 3.5 year journey for us. It started with a public records request that I came across my desk. I was the sergeant, the team leader, and I kind of took care of those public records requests so the detectives could do their thing. And there was reams and reams of paper when I printed these things out. And my background, I think I told you, was in accounting. I was a CPA. I figured, hey, I'm organized. I can kind of sit down and figure this out. So I kind of locked myself up for a while in a room and tried to figure out all the clues and the photos, and I couldn't figure it out. So I decided, hey, we need to assemble a pretty elite team. And I was able to get this cast of characters, so to speak, these talented, hardworking cold case detectives to join me. And we literally rode a roller coaster ride for about 3.5 years.
For Troy and the cold case squad, it became personal and there was no going back. The obsession to solve the case took them to Philadelphia, where they presented their case to the VDOC Society. The big takeaway was that the killer would be in their files. Investigators would go back to the beginning. They put a plan in place to go over the 800 names that they'd identified in the files. Troy would start with Z and go backwards. Another detective started at A. They had plans to meet in the middle. If you'll recall from last week, Troy and his team would take it one step further. They did something unconventional at the time. They hired genetic genealogist Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick. They would provide her with a DNA profile of the killer, which she would use to trace his family history. So they gave her his profile in early December 2014. But by the holidays, Troy would receive a call from Dr. Fitzpatrick. She believed the family name that matched the DNA profile was Miller.
I rush into headquarters, ask Mark, who's kind of my guru of organization. He was one of the things we needed to do initially was get organized. So Mark pulled the files from the basement and he plops them in. He goes, there you go. There's the 5 files of Miller. And I remember sitting in my office, got through the first couple, and really wasn't, you know, anything glaring about these particular Millers. When I came across Brian Patrick Miller, I think it was file 668, I just stopped. And it was, again, a moment I'll never forget.
When he got to Brian Patrick Miller and started reading the file, the hairs on the back of his neck stood up. He couldn't believe it when he saw an anonymous tipster who had called in saying that he'd seen Brian Patrick Miller with a child-sized bodysuit, just like the one they'd seen on the news. The information about the bodysuit had been released to the public.
So that original file, it had a header sheet, and it basically said it was an anonymous tip, and it had come in, I believe it was the spring of 1994. So the second murder had happened in the fall of 1993. The tip had come in, and it said something about a roommate of Brian had seen Brian Patrick Miller with a similar bodysuit as the one found on the second victim. And there was a indication that Brian worked at the St. Vincent de Paul's, rode his bike, that was known to steal women's undergarments. from there. And then the file, just for lack of whatever words, got more intriguing as far as you know, turn the page and there's more on arson, there's shoplifting, and there's curfew violations, and he's heavily involved in bikes.
Troy was sickened as he continued to read through the file. How in the late 1980s, when Miller was a teenager, he'd gotten on the bus and noticed a woman.
One of the things that struck me was when I came across, so in 1989, I believe it was, Brian Miller got on a bus and took it to the east side, northeast side of Phoenix, got off that bus and stabbed a woman in the back. He ended up getting caught, but the thought that he stabbed her in the back, same as our other two victims in the back, it just blew me away. And then when the detectives asked him on that particular, I guess, attempted murder, because she ended up surviving, they asked him why he did it, and he said it sent chills up his spine. So that sent chills up my spine. The fact that all this is just coming together, this file.
Because Miller was in his teens, he was sent to a juvenile detention center. When he was set to be released on his 18th birthday, his mother tried to intervene. She brought a journal entry into the court, something she'd found in his bedroom.
The day, so he goes to juvenile, corrections, and he serves a sentence, and his mother turns in on the day he's supposed to get out. She walks into one of our precincts and turns in what we call the plan. And the plan was in this file also. The plan basically named a woman and described her, and then described exactly what he wanted to do to her in very, very detailed, grotesque. And it was very similar to our first victim. And it ended up with a bucket of blood and a knife and a fork and cannibalism. And so the plan was dropped off by his mother because she didn't want him to get out, because she thought, I think, he was a danger to society. But somebody in juvenile said, oh, this is not, you know, a psychologist or somebody said, oh, these are just fantasies. He's not a danger.
When you saw that and you're reading all that, that's in the file, right? All this backstory.
The plan was in the file, yeah.
And what were you thinking?
I was just blown away.
Despite the journal entry, Miller would be released in 1990. After reading Brian Patrick Miller's file, Troy called in the cavalry.
We assembled an immediate team meeting to come together and to talk about it. And I think my team was as excited as I was, but it's like, wow, this is all lining up. And from what we're discovering about this Brian Patrick Miller, he looks good for it.
So everybody else that was on your team, you're in the office, it's Christmas time, and they come on board too, right?
They were all absolutely hardworking, tenacious, and the fact that we potentially had a major break in the most important cold cases we had worked on, not to say the others aren't important, but this was galactic in terms of what had been done. So yeah, to pull them in and get them started.
The first question on everybody's mind was, where is this guy? Is he still alive? Is he in jail? It had taken them more than 20 years to get the possible answer to this question, and what they would find would shock them. Not only was Brian Patrick Miller still alive, he was living in Arizona, a 42-year-old divorcee who had full custody of his teenage daughter, and the two of them lived together in an apartment in Phoenix. Miller worked at an Amazon fulfillment center. On the outside looking in, if he was the so-called Canal River killer, he'd been hiding in plain sight for 22 years. And he wasn't anything like the Rambo-type military guy that they thought he would be. He was the reverse of that. He was described as nerdy-looking. They found out that he was heavily involved in the steampunk cosplay scene. In fact, he had created a character called the Zombie Hunter, and he dressed the part, wearing a bloodied trench coat, goggles, or a completely creepy-looking gas mask that covered his entire face. He wore a metal helmet and carried a huge, imposing fake gun. And then there was his vehicle, a former cop car that he drove everywhere. Now, most people, when they buy a retired patrol car at an auction, they try to downplay the fact that it was once a police car. Miller leaned into it. His vehicle was decked out with a full spread of lights on the top of the roof, just like a regular cop car, and over the back of the trunk in bold official-looking print, his alter ego, Zombie Hunter. The whole thing, the vehicle, the creepy gas mask and helmet, the trench coat and former police car splashed with blood, that he had this weird dummy that he kept in the back seat. The huge fake over-the-top gun was very much reminiscent of a villain on the Walking Dead TV show. Miller would be invited to take part in parades and festivals, and he also appeared at zombie-themed parties. But the Cold Case Squad would get a punch in the gut as they poured into Miller's background and came upon a photo of him in his full zombie costume posing with two Phoenix police officers in front of his blood-splattered Zombie Hunter mobile at an event. You know, they've done studies and it takes about a solid 2 months to create a good habit, which in the scheme of things doesn't sound long at all when you consider the long-term benefits of whatever it is you're trying to do. For many of us, doesn't it always come down to eating right and stress? For me, they go hand in hand because around day 4 to 5, you've had a rough go of it. Maybe your boss is a jerk, your commute stunk, fill in the blank. And then you get home and you don't want to cook. Because you didn't go grocery shopping, and even if you had, you don't want any of that stuff. You want a delicious, ooey-gooey cheeseburger and fries. That'll make you feel better. But that's the thing. You and me both know it doesn't. So how do you stay on track when the stresses of life get you down and you're busy or tired or meh, and you don't feel like cooking? Factor. Factor offers 2-minute meals that are restaurant quality and ready to heat and eat wherever and whenever you are. And you can get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every single week, which are delivered right to your door. So quit with the excuses and do something good for yourself. Give Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals a try. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef-crafted and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. So what are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. Head to factormeals.com/mischief50. That's M-I-S-C-H-I-E-F 50. And use code MISCHIEF50 to get 50% off. That's code MISCHIEF50 at factormeals.com/mischief50 to get 50% off.
Then we learn about, you know, the steampunk and the zombie hunter and the zombie hunter mobile where he's got a mannequin in the back and he goes to all these Comic-Con events. So he's posing with police officers. So Richard, the profiler, talked about this particular subtype loves to use these sarcastic ruses where they're taunting the police. Well, he was taunting us even in 2013 when he's taking photos with police officers. He's basically saying, hey, I did it. You guys are too stupid to figure it out.
Investigators knew they had to get a DNA sample from this Brian Patrick Miller right away. As they surveilled Miller, investigators were having a tough time reconciling who they thought the canal killer would be based on the blitz style of attack, the precision stab wounds to kill his victims instantly, and the stealth and strength it would take to drag the victims to a hidden space near the bike path. It just didn't seem to compute with the person that they were following.
All of us had this, again, this military, we were looking far and wide at the military base theory that maybe somebody came in. We have a major one, Luke Air Force Base here in Phoenix. Somebody with that John Rambo, somebody also strong enough to drag both women lifeless all those distances and then not get caught. So we had this sense of military badass. And then we see Brian Miller and he's a scrawny little nerdy fellow with glasses and just, you know, we see a video of him back in the time, the era of when he committed these murders, and he seemed puny. And it's just, you know, to this day, it's hard to fathom how he did this.
One of the detectives had an idea. He thought about Miller's psychology, how he basically advertised himself to the world as the zombie hunter in his converted police car, which to him screamed wannabe cop.
And basically his idea was to set up a job interview with Miller. And Miller took the bait. He went up and said, hey, I conduct security. Clark or my detective did say, hey, I conduct security for a company that's just to the north of where you're working at this Amazon. We've had a lot of theft through this parking lot. Would you be willing to work security for us? And Miller again took the bait and they set up this job interview at Chili's.
I mean, that's a really good idea, knowing what his psychological profile is. And of course, someone like that's going to want to be in a position of power over other people. Like, I'm sure he probably tried to be a police officer or something at some time in his life, right? So
his mother was a detention officer.
How did he approach Miller to make it seem plausible? Like, he was just walking down the street and he knew he took his breaks there. And that's when he's like, hey, you seem like somebody. Like, how did he...
Clark is very, very intelligent and had worked on, been the, kind of the lead investigator on another serial shooting. He's just a brilliant guy. So again, I think, yeah, he knew that this would be good bait. He knew that driving around the zombie hunter car, and there's a fascination with security and police work and that kind of thing. He was just tired. He said, you know, Troy, I'm just tired of waiting. Let's get his DNA.
So the cold case team goes to the Chili's restaurant ahead of their suspect, Brian Patrick Miller. They're getting everything set up perfectly to collect his DNA off of whatever he ate or drank at the table during this phony job interview. But things didn't go according to plan.
We were excited. So we basically prepped and set up what I call the controlled environment up there at Chili's. We had the manager on board, very cooperative, and we cleaned the utensils and got everything ready. And we were actually sitting in booths when Brian came rolling up to meet my Detective Clark. What was crazy about the Chili's, though, is he brought his 15-year-old daughter with him to the job interview. And we're kind of looking at each other like, who does that? Why would you do that? I don't know if it was to get her a free meal or what. So that threw a hiccup. We had to keep eyes on who was eating what and kind of threw us into, so we didn't even know if we were going to get DNA because he gobbled down a whole sandwich and only took one drink. So we were thinking, what are we going to do? We're going to have to do this thing over. So we ended up just sending it to the lab, all the utensils and the cup.
And then the cold case team waited on pins and needles. Would this be another dead end? I mean, this guy, Brian Patrick Miller, based on his records, seemed good for it. But then so had so many of the other men. After about 2 weeks...
We're having a meeting over grants or something for the next series to go over cold cases. And the door storms open to the conference room and in parades this group of scientists. The crime lab is newly built. It's nice. The headquarters is where we're sitting is very dilapidated. It's so they don't come to us. We come to them. So the fact that they're walking through the door is just crazy. And I had a few missed phone calls from Kelly, the DNA supervisor. So she comes in and they're like, you did it. You got him. It's him. And there was a pause and I think, you know, just disbelief, just kind of, shell shocked of what, you know, kind of we'd been on this 3.5 year journey and you're telling it's really Miller. We hugged, we got excited. And then things got crazy in terms of notifications were made. That room went from 10 people to about 100. And all over the department, it was buzzing as to how do we get this guy? Let's get the SWAT team. Let's get him in custody, that kind of thing.
So who called the victim's families? When did that take place?
I ended up calling the victim's families. We ended up sending out, both of them were out of state. So we wanted to make sure that they had local authorities involved so that, you know, we didn't blindside them and kind of deliver the message. And then at least the cursory, hey, give Troy a call. So I ended up talking to him, and that was both William and Marianne, the case agents, were in interviews, very vital. William was interviewing the zombie hunter, and Marianne was going to interview his daughter. So I was in a position to be able to do that, and it was phenomenal to be able to tell them we got him.
It makes me want to cry right now. I mean, you had to have been so just electrified, because a lot of people don't get that reward at the end. I mean, I know you're not doing it for the reward, but that's a pretty sweet reward, right?
It was just massive to be told all those years he's dead, you guys are stupid, why are you trying, you know, and to finally be able to figure it out and to just methodically just keep working. And yeah, I was just so proud of my team and what we had done. And I remember calling my wife and I said, I can't tell you a lot, but I'm gonna tell you before media breaks that we did this. You can't say a word. I said, but I'm not gonna see you for a while. So yeah, but it was just, I get choked up even now talking about it, but phenomenal, highlight of my career for sure.
After so many years, in 2015, knowing that Brian Patrick Miller's DNA was a match for the semen left at both crime scenes, even so, when the detective walks into that interrogation room and Miller is sitting there, he plays it cool.
Detective Shriver, how are you?
Nervous.
Do you want a water or soda or anything?
Water would be great.
Just regular water?
The detective is biding his time. He eases in, doesn't tell Miller why he's there. He just starts asking questions about his family and growing up in Arizona, establishing rapport. Miller would share that his mother had been extremely abusive towards him.
How was your childhood growing up with all that going on?
Me and my mom? Horrible.
What made it horrible?
Physical abuse.
When you say physical abuse, because that's kind of a vague
term. Being beaten, didn't matter if I did something wrong. If she did something and forgot she did it, I would get a beating for it if I showed.
What kind of beating?
Belt, but she used her security belt, so like a law enforcement belt. And usually I hit by the buckles.
So how long did that, was that started when you're like 10 or 11-ish?
It started when I was 5, right after
dad died? And
like the week after. And it went on for 10 years and it stopped. One day she went to her room to get the belt, came out with it, and I was sitting in the hallway, and as soon as I saw her with the belt, I kicked my foot through the wall, and I said, "You're not hitting me anymore." And she turned around, put the belt away, and just left me alone.
You're about 15?
Yeah.
Miller was quick to point out that he'd made peace with his mom, and that when he'd moved to Washington State in his mid-20s, he and his wife, Amy, had actually lived with his mother.
When they moved to Washington, we actually moved in with my mom, and for the most part, that worked out.
The detective casually asks Miller if he'd gotten into any trouble when he was young. Of course, he already knew the answer to that.
During those time periods, did you ever have to go to counseling or anything like that? Did you ever lash out as you got older?
Yeah, I lashed out. I got in trouble.
What kind of things did you get in trouble for?
Shoplifting, criminal damage. I did assault someone in my teen years. The juvie.
What happened there?
It was kind of blacked out and, you know, hurt someone. And someone noticed later that the person looked a lot like my mom.
When you say someone, is that like a counselor or?
No, it was just a random person. And someone I'd never met before. And, but.
What happened in that assault or how did it happen?
Something I really don't know anything about. Because it's totally not me.
Miller would say that he didn't like talking about what he'd done to that woman. A stranger he'd stabbed in the back multiple times after they disembarked from that bus. The detective backs off from the attack, casually pivots, asking, "Hey, did you do any journaling when you were a teenager?" Again, he already knows the answer to that question.
Dogs. Really liked cars, so I drew cars. Was terrible at things like landscapes, people.
They ever have you write about your feelings or anything like that?
They would have me draw out my feelings. You know, like if I was feeling sad, draw something that expresses the emotion.
Miller didn't say anything to the detective about his journal entry, the one that his mom had brought to the court when he was about to be released. If you'll recall, Troy mentioned it earlier. It had been in the investigation file all these years under Brian Patrick Miller's name. Miller's plan that he'd written as a teen started off with 1, kidnap the girl, 2, tie her up in the truck, 3, take her out to the desert, 4, cut her clothes off. We'll stop at 4. Because we already know what he did. His graphic plans, back then, included sadistic descriptions of what he would do to his victims. Sexually assaulting, carving, stabbing, mutilating, murder. Essentially the playbook of what he'd done to Angela and Melanie. At this point, if this interrogation was a chess match, the detective makes his first offensive move on the board when he pulls out and lays down on the interrogation table that journal entry titled Plan.
Do you remember writing anything like this?
Honestly, no. That does look like my handwriting.
Looks like your handwriting. Oh, would it surprise you if I told you that your mom brought this to the police department back about that time frame?
I wouldn't be surprised if it was something I did.
Cool. Does this, why would you write something like
that? Honestly, I don't know.
Could be anger issues, just about women in general because of what you went through with your mom?
This looks more like something from a movie.
From a movie? What kind of movie are you watching?
Well, my mom used to like horror movies.
So you wouldn't ever act out on something like that?
No.
That's written in there?
The detective would ask Miller about his sex life, and he would say that before he met his wife, he'd only had sex with one other person, a sex worker. And when he was asked about his sex life with his ex-wife, he would describe it as normal. Miller's description was the exact opposite of what Amy, his ex-wife, would tell detectives. She would say that their sex life had gotten scary. Miller's demands of violent role-playing terrified her. Bondage, S&M, that at some point he had brought a knife into their bedroom, that he'd carved into her skin and licked the blood. According to Amy, this behavior is what led to their divorce. At this point in the interrogation, all of the detective's previous questions had a purpose. And now, they had at long last culminated into the final countdown. They had spent the last hour getting to it, the Canal murders, and Miller still hadn't been told why he was there. But he had to have had an idea. Or maybe not. What Miller didn't realize is that during that hour-long interrogation, the detective had locked in his story. His own answers had put him in a checkmate situation, because they had his DNA on the bodies of his victims. I mean, how did it get there if he wasn't the killer? Miller would say that he didn't like riding his bike on the canal, and that the underpass tunnels scared him, which is why he never used them.
You know where the tunnel is that goes under the canal, or goes under the freeway, end up, like, right by Gulf. Castles and Coasters, I think, is what they call it now. You know which bike trails I'm talking about?
I know which ones you're talking about.
Did you frequent those at all for anything? Stay away from those. Did you ever go under that, under the bridge?
Those always scared me. That's why I didn't take them.
Had you taken them?
I may have taken them once and then didn't like it.
Miller also shared that before his divorce, he'd only had sex with two people. A sex worker, before he was married, and then his wife. And when asked if there was any way his DNA could have gotten anywhere near the canal, he said no.
Now, do you ever have sex with anybody else before her then, or?
A prostitute when I was 18, Mexican girl.
Do you ever have any, what I'll call a weenie wagger episodes, where you maybe masturbated out in public?
No.
So, if you masturbated, I mean, your DNA wouldn't be anywhere out in the public just floating around.
Not likely.
Then, the detective would drop the hammer.
So in that early 90s area, you were in the Phoenix area. Mm-hmm. You lived in there. And do you remember hearing any news articles about any ladies being killed?
Probably saw a few.
Do you remember any specific ones? And you told me that around the Metro Center area on the bike paths, on the canals, you weren't ever around there. Maybe once in a while.
Yeah, once in a while, not like a regular thing.
Do you remember the name Angela Brasso at all? Well, she was killed around the bike paths in 1992. And then in 1993, there's a girl by the name of Melanie Burnett who was also killed around the bike, you know, the canals and the bike paths over there. And there's some DNA evidence that kind of links you to those girls. Is there any way you can explain that to them?
No, but I don't know those names.
Well, any girl in particular, whether you remember their name or not, how would your DNA evidence be linked to them? You have no clue about two girls that were killed and your DNA being linked to their bodies. And those letters that you wrote when you were younger that your mom gave us, you kind of recognize those as being your handwriting. Very similar characteristics in those letters to what happened to these young ladies. And now years later, we have DNA that links you to those two ladies.
Yeah.
Well, how else would you know what DNA is?
Yeah, right? I know what DNA is.
Okay, what is DNA to you? Where does it come from?
DNA could be in semen, blood, saliva. It's makes up our, it's our ID, it's our, tells our body, what hair color we have, what eye color we have.
And you know the numbers on DNA, like what your specific DNA is to how many gazillions of people, and it can only be you. It's in the trillions. So what I'm telling you is your DNA is linked to both these women who were killed. So I'm just curious, if you only had sex with the prostitute and only had sex with your wife, were never around the area around Metro Center where these ladies were found, one was up by her apartments on Cactus, one was by the canal, how can you explain to me that your DNA is there?
I can't remember everything I did back then, but I know I didn't kill anyone.
Well, I would think that you would remember if you did something like that.
Yeah, I would.
So are you sure you don't want to, now's your chance, kind of come and tell me, is there a reason something like that happened? Would help you get it off your chest if you did something like that.
I didn't kill anyone.
You didn't kill anybody? But yeah, you can't explain to me how your DNA is there.
I don't.
Throughout the interview, Miller would say that he wasn't the killer, that he'd never murdered anyone. And yet, he couldn't explain how his DNA had been found on both the victims. Miller was charged for the murders of Angela and Melanie. 7 long years after his arrest, he would finally face a judge. During his trial, his defense didn't argue that he didn't murder Angela and Melanie, but that his abusive childhood had made him not responsible for his actions, that he was not guilty by reason of insanity. His attorneys would say that he had no memory of murdering Angela and Melanie because he suffered from complex dissociative disorder as a result of his abusive traumatic childhood, that he'd been diagnosed with PTSD and sexual sadism, a disorder where a person is sexually aroused by extreme pain, suffering, or the humiliation of others. His attorneys would paint a grim childhood of suffering from physical, psychological, and emotional abuse, allegedly at the hands of his own mother.
So Brian was an only child. His mother was a detention officer, and there was some speculation that she could never become a full-fledged police officer because of psych issues or something like that. His father was in the Army. They're living out in Hawaii when he's 5. His father passes away from a motorcycle accident. So you've got a boy who's with his mother who's possibly psych issues, and his father passes away in a motorcycle accident. So you see maybe we start to build this, these environmental factors that contributed towards all this. They end up moving to Phoenix and moving in with his mother Ellen's parents in North Phoenix. This is all coming from Brian and some other of his relatives. Basically, he was abused in terms of he was forced to watch, Playboy, and he was forced to watch pretty graphic horror movies at a young age. His mother also, he brought up in court that he dropped a pizza one time and he was riding on his bike, and she made him eat it with rocks in it. So, she wasn't really there, especially during the court phase, to really defend herself. And I always say she couldn't have been that bad because he made the decision as an adult in the late 90s to go live with her in the state of Washington. So, so him and his wife packed up and their daughter and ended up living with Ellen. So if she was that much of a monster, I maybe you'd forgiven her or what. But he had definitely had a rough childhood, but there's also a lot of people that have had rough childhoods that don't turn out to be serial killers.
On April 11th, 2023, Brian Patrick Miller was found guilty of the murders, kidnappings, and sexual assaults of Angela Brasso and Melanie Burness. Before his sentencing, Miller would address the judge, hoping for life behind bars without the possibility of parole over the death penalty.
Good afternoon. I am not looking for sympathy today. This time is for the family and the friends of the victims. I cannot imagine what pain they have endured for all these years. I know this has been a long and painful process for everyone. I wish I could provide answers to the questions you have. I know I am different. I didn't understand completely why. I thought I had to do with what my mother did to me. I want to do whatever I can to help my daughter. I was not a perfect father, but I tried my best. I am sorry for the damage this experience has caused her. I miss her.
Miller would never actually apologize for murdering Angela and Melanie. He spent most of his time talking about himself. The judge would sentence him to death. During this process, from the time he was arrested and charged to before his trial and sentencing, authorities and family members held out hope that Miller would confess to more crimes. The Phoenix Police Department believes that Brian Patrick Miller is responsible for at least two murders in Arizona. In May of 1992, 13-year-old Brandy Lynn Myers went missing and was never found. Brandy disappeared just two doors down from Miller's home when she was last seen in the neighborhood collecting money for a school fundraiser. The lead detective on that case, who has since retired, Stuart Summershoe, sat down with KPHO News.
I feel like Brandy was probably one of his victims, and she's kind of been forgotten in all of this. There were dozens of images of homicide scenes of women being decapitated, women being tortured. Within his home, he had a lot of images of that, of, you know, sadism, cannibalism, necrophilia. I mean, cannibalism was an aspect in some of the stuff he was into that he was looking at online and things like that. One of my personal theories is the zombie hunter. Zombie, you know, people are into zombies and Walking Dead and all that. But Brian was really into it, and it's almost a socially acceptable way to talk about cannibalism, you know, eating people, because that's what zombies do. And as depraved as he was, I find it hard to believe he was able just to stop. Knowing what I know about him, there probably is more victims that we don't know about or we haven't identified.
Miller's ex-wife, Amy, would tell Crime Watch Daily that at some point in their marriage, Miller had confided to her that he'd murdered a girl who matched Brandy's profile.
He said he had grabbed her and dragged her into his house. He had stabbed her and then cut her throat and killed her. His description was he then placed her body into a bathtub, had intended to fill it with cold water, and accidentally had filled it with hot water because he was so excited, I guess, was his best description. And then chopped up her body and placed in his trash can until the next trash day. After having been questioned by the police, I have to believe that it was an actual true incident, and I have to believe that he most likely was guilty of that.
Amy would tell police that the reason she hadn't come forward was because she didn't think it was real, that it was just part of his bizarre fantasies. Police believe that Miller could be responsible for the murder of 16-year-old Shannon Olmark, whose body was found not long after Brandy went missing in 1992. In fact, searchers were looking for Brandy, and that's when they found Shannon. Miller has not been charged in Brandy's disappearance and presumed murder, or Shannon's murder. Investigators also believe, as the FBI profile suggested, that Miller had stopped killing in Arizona because he moved on and killed elsewhere. We know that he moved to Washington State when he was 25 years old, 13 years before his arrest in the Canal murders, when Miller was living in Washington State. Melissa Ruiz Ramirez had been out walking on May 23, 2002, when she accepted a ride from Miller. She felt safe in doing so because she knew him from her friend's apartment complex. During that drive, Miller would pull out a 12-inch serrated knife, and he began stabbing her with it. Melissa was able to get away, and Miller was arrested. But he would claim self-defense, saying that she had tried to rob him, and the jury had returned a not guilty verdict. Miller had moved back to Arizona after the acquittal. Because he was exonerated, Washington State hadn't required him to submit a DNA sample in 2002. According to Troy, in 2000, a 14-year-old girl, Victoria Mickelson, was on a bike path near her home in Everett, Washington, when she encountered a man who stabbed her more than 15 times. Victoria was able to get away, and she survived the attack. Police never linked Miller officially to the crime, and after 7 years, the case was purged from their records. However, Victoria believes that her attacker that day was Brian Patrick Miller, and in that case, no charges have ever been filed against him. Troy said that when his detective spoke to Victoria in 2015, that she'd wanted them to charge Miller with attempted murder, but they couldn't because it wasn't in their jurisdiction. At this time, Miller is appealing his murder convictions, and he's not talking about his alleged other crimes. Before I let you go, I wanted to thank Troy for participating in the show. I love his passion for cold cases.
We were on cloud nine. We flew back to Chicago, won a national award. for criminal investigation. You know, just everything was going good. Other people were calling us, how do you do it? How do you start a cold case squad? That kind of thing. And then in 2016, 2017, they folded the squad. I'm holding my second daughter. She's colicky, you know, trying to bounce her. And then I get this call from my commander, who was retiring in 2 weeks, and he said, hey, you're going back to patrol, Troy. And I was like, commander, I said, with all due respect, I said, we've been solving about 12 to 15 cold cases a year. And we just gave you a serial killer that was alive and well that everybody else said he's dead. And so, you know, he said he basically didn't care. And nobody seemed to care. And so the cold case squad went away. I found another home. And I went through a really tough time because I believe that cold cases matter. And for whatever reason, you've got to have support for that. So at that point, I sat down and I wrote a book. My mom was a teacher. I loved to write. So I wrote this book and I've been waiting to publish it. So I'm working to tell this story about how we never gave up on our 3.5 year journey. So that's kind of, and my mantra is, again, cold cases matter. And that's, I've retired, and that's kind of why I'm trying to, this consultant, advocate, author, trying to help. And I would love to help other agencies develop cold case reviews and develop systematic processes. It's just Troy Hillman, coldcase.com. So it's TROYHILLMAN, cold, COLD, case, CASE.com.
Please make sure you visit Troy Hillman's author website for updates on his upcoming book. Also, don't forget to check out our bonus episode, up next, on Criminal Mischief with Carolyn and Brandon. And if you enjoy the show, we would love it if you took a moment to head on over to Apple Podcasts to rate and review the show. It really helps. And as always, thanks for listening. From Cloud 10, Criminal Mischief is a Pie in the Sky production, recorded in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. We're produced by Brandon Morgan and myself, music by Soundstripe. I'm Carolyn Osorio, your writer and host.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.